Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who is a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of the Cognitive Sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and he has an article at Explore, From One to the Many, The Social Implications of Non-Local Perception. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Hello, and good to talk to you again, Ian.
And I'm very interested in this idea that you've explored in this article in Explore, From the One to the Many, The Social Implications of Non-Local Perception, particularly as it may affect global warming in the sense that, you know, with the White House report that just came out yesterday saying it's a clear and present danger, there's nothing theoretical about it, and the idea that this is a global problem that should elicit a kind of global response, in effect, a form of global patriotism for us all to get together to defend our Mother Earth. And this idea that you're exploring here, that the possibility that a mass of people having an individual but linked experience could have an effect when a great event such as the threat to the planet from global warming synchronizes the feelings of millions of people to achieve what facts and logic cannot. So could you elaborate?
Well, the idea for this came out of a body of research that's been done at laboratories around the world, in which the typical research protocol is we're going to provide some kind of stimulus, either a visual or auditory stimulus. And what they discover is that just shortly before you actually get the stimulus, there is a psychophysical response. For instance, a typical one would be you're staring at a television monitor and it's just black, but periodically a picture appears on it, controlled by a random number generator, and when that happens, just a few tenths of a second before you actually see the picture, your eyes dilate in anticipation of it. So you're physically responding before you're cognitively aware of what's going on. That's the original research premise. And there are probably about 50 double-blind randomized protocol studies that have been done showing that in fMRIs or in EEGs or in audio stuff, that a variety of different protocols all show that the body seems to respond before we're cognitively aware. That's the first part. And then a researcher at Princeton University named Roger Nelson, while he was still at Princeton, he's retired now, but still continuing this, asked the question, well, if this is an individual response that we're seeing in the laboratory, is it possible that there is a mass response in the same way? That is, if one individual does this, if there's some big catalyzing event that lies in the future, do masses of individuals have this presentment experience? And he created a very stringent protocol that he's been doing now for about 10 years, in which he has random number generators all over the world, and he notices that when these random number generators are running 24/7 as they do, and there is some mass catalyzing emotional event which focuses the attention of people all over the world, most recently, for instance, Nelson Mandela's death, then these random number generators go non-random. And what this is suggesting to us is that this and other research is that all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent, that we live in a matrix of life. And I think it's important, you know, within the Judeo-Christian worldview, we live on the earth and we have dominion over the earth. But the truth is that we live in the earth. There are a couple of miles of life beneath us, beneath our feet. And, of course, it goes many miles up into the above us. And we live sort of embedded in the biosphere of earth. And the research from a variety of fields, from medicine to physics to biology, is telling us that all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent. That we, it's kind of like the movie The Matrix. You know, we live in a matrix of life, and that the final part of this is that neuroscience is beginning to look at how people react to ideological and theological issues, and they discover that that brain function has a very big role in our political and theological beliefs. And so we have really reached a point now where neuroscience is becoming political. And that was what prompted me to write the paper, because if you look at this, you see that about 27% of the country, of the world probably, but the, most of this research in the United States, have overactive amygdalas. That's the little almond-sized component within the brain, which is involved with fight or flight, and that that when this is stimulated, and the presentment, the anticipation of something stimulates it, that it very strongly affects our behavior, and it is associated with conservative politics and fundamentalist theology. So you realize that not only do people have the not only do they have very strong emotional feelings, but that that this really is based on brain structure, and that we need to realize that a large percentage of the population is being controlled essentially by brain function, and that they their fears, because the amygdala is associated with fear and it's the fight or flight mechanism, that the presentment of oncoming crisis like the climate change is evoking a fear response which transcends rational thought. I've been thinking about this since you asked me to do this interview, and I wonder whether the obsession with vampires and zombies, which seems very strange to me, but is nonetheless a big part of American culture, does not arise out of this presentment of fear that we have about what is coming with climate change, because it is going to be catastrophic, as all these reports, the IPCC report, the report just came out of the White House. We are going into a world which is radically different than the one most of us grew up in.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and he has an article that explores, from one to the many, the social implications of non-local perception. So this idea that either political attitudes are either encoded in our brain structure through our experiences, or that our brain structure in some way determines or results in our political attitudes, the origins are in running away from the saber-toothed tiger and ending up voting for Mitt Romney.
Well, yes. I mean, that actually is, I mean, it sounds kind of exaggerated, but it's actually true. What we see when we look at this, I mean, for instance, researchers at the University College of London showed that greater conservatism was associated with increased volume of the right amygdala, which is this ancient brain structure, and in all species who have amygdalas, it plays the same role, and that's this, it's responsible for our fear response, a sort of fight-or-flight response, and it transcends rational thought, because, you know, you're just responding out of fear. A neurologist at University College made the point it's significant that this happens, because this association with political attitudes appear to be encoded in brain structure, and that that means that trying to argue about facts, for instance, in terms of climate change, facts are simply not dispositive. These people are responding out of deep-seated fear and emotion, and they're just facts just don't make any difference. And you see that almost every day. And if you read the right-wing media, you listen to the right-wing electronic media, I mean, it's astonishing to me that paper after paper, report after report comes out telling us what's coming. And, for instance, in North Carolina, the Senate passed a rule you can't use climate change. You can't mention it. It's like, you know, if we put our hands and our fingers in our ears and close our eyes and crouch down, that maybe it won't happen.
Well, I believe they also passed a law banning Priuses as well in North Carolina.
It is very bizarre because you have to realize when you look at this what's going on with climate change that there's some deep-seated non-rational response to this that is being evoked. Now, obviously, some people, people like the Koch brothers, I mean, they have great financial interests in the continuation of the carbon era, and it's easy to understand why, quite rationally, they want to do this. I had an interesting conversation flying back not too long ago with the people that flew me out were kind enough to put me in first class, and so I flew back with sitting next to a hedge fund manager, and I said to him, you know, don't you realize this is going to happen to your kids as well as mine? And his response was, I think, very telling. He said, I have enough money to deal with it. And I thought, you know, these people, I guess they live in gated communities, and so they figure, what, we'll put a dome over it and create our own environment? I don't quite get it, but it was he was so very straightforward and nonchalant about it when I said, you do realize what's coming with climate change, and well, it's exaggerated. And then I said, I kept pressing, and he finally said, well, I have enough money to solve whatever the problem is for my immediate family.
So he'll have his own Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
We go back a full circle. But so then what is there in any practical political sense? Is there a way that we can find a way to reduce this kind of amygdala response, this ancient flight from the saber-toothed tiger, in effect reduce fear? Because I think another subtext of the Republican agenda and how they get white men in particular to vote against their own interests is through fear of the demographic changes, fear that the minorities are taking over.
Yes, I think there are several major trends. You know, I look at trends. I spend a lot of each day examining data. I don't read polemics. I read data, actual peer-reviewed research published in journals and things like that. And thinking about this question, and there are three big trends which are clearly dominating, although they don't get discussed in the corporate media at all, but there are three big trends that are really driving a great deal of what's going on politically. One is the fear of the coming white minority, which is a huge deal because never since 1609, Jamestown or the Mayflower or anything, from the very beginning of the colonization of North America, Caucasians have been the dominant policymakers. And now for the first time really in our history, if you think about that, hundreds of years, that is no longer going to be true. And for a certain segment of the population, that is incredibly fear-inducing. Because for the first time in American history, being born white will not confer in and of itself privilege. And that's very scary. That's one. The other one is the issue of gender equality. Now, I think that gender equality is important because those countries which have the greatest gender equality, and you can see this, by the way, in patents. If you look at the countries that have the most patents, which you can think of as creativity of a certain kind, those countries which have the most creativity have the, produce the most patents. And, for instance, if you look at a country like Japan, Japan produces more patents in a year than the entire Islamic world produces in a decade. And it has to do with the suppression of women. Those cultures which have gender equality will have the most neurons working on their behalf. And those countries which keep half the population out of the game, and it takes between 7% and 12% of the other half to maintain that structure of repression, they just don't have enough neurons working the problem. That's so gender equality. And the third one is the assimilation of minorities. Again, for the same reason, because if you look at creative acts, whether it's startup businesses, whether it's patents, whether it's music, whether it's artworks, whether it's literature, you can see that those nations which have the greatest equality produce over time the greatest creative acts in all of these fields, whether it's science or the arts or whatever, so that those countries which have policies which create gender equality and which work with the assimilation of minorities and which recognize that the dominance of Caucasians is no longer going to be the predominant racial power structure of the world. I mean, just look at the Chinese, for instance, or the Indians, or the Brazilians. You can see that there are massive changes that are coming, climate change, of course, being the deep bass note that's behind all of it. You can see that these major trends, which are shaping our world and are almost undiscussed, that those which choose compassionate, make those countries which make compassionate, life-affirming choices are going to prosper, and those that don't, won't. And you can also see it in the great schism that is occurring in the United States between the blue value states and the red value states. I mean, the red value states, you have a shorter life expectancy, you have more obesity, more type 2 diabetes, more child molestation, more teen pregnancy, more incarceration, lower literacy rates. The blue states underwrite the red states. Blue states tend to put more in, for every dollar they put into the federal treasury, they take a little bit less than a dollar out, and those states which have red values put a dollar in and take sometimes substantially more than a dollar out. So we can see in our own country, but this is going on all over the planet, but we can see in our own country that those social policies which support compassion and life-affirming activities are prospering, and those which do not aren't.
Well, just in closing though, Stephen Schwartz, the rising sea level will not discriminate between red or blue states or between the conscious and the unconscious.
Yes, we're going to see three major migrations, I believe. One is away from the coastlines, and that's going to affect everybody. About 52% of the population lives within 200 miles of a seacoast or at less than 30 feet. So all of that high-rent property along the coastlines, like Malibu up where you live or Santa Monica, they're going to be in desperate trouble, and there's going to be a migration away from the coast in the American Southwest and the Central Plains states. There's going to be a migration out because there's just not enough water. Cities like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Tucson are just going to be unsustainable at the, in the way that they are currently operating. You just aren't going to be able to have those nice green lawns that you see in Las Vegas. So we're going to see a migration out of the Southwest and out of the central states because of water. And we're going to see a final one in a migration into those states which are going to pay more in terms of minimum wage, that have policies that are proactive about climate change, and that have better health care. So there's going to be a big shift of demographics in the United States, and the failure of the red value social policies is going to become more and more apparent, not based on polemics or ideology or any of that, but just based on social outcomes. You know, social values produce social outcomes.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and he has an article at Explore, From One to the Many, The Social Implications of Non-Local Perception. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.